This is the Literary License Podcast with your hosts, Vicky Ray, John Wilson, and Keith Shorgo, discussing book to screen and everything in between, coming at you from the UK and USA.
They keep it real.
It doesn't make sense to me.
What does?
Women aren't that unpredictable.
Well, I can't guess what you're thinking.
A woman has a favorite handbag, and it always hangs on her bedpost where she can get at it easily. And then all of a sudden she goes away on a trip and leaves it behind. Why?
Because she didn't know she was going on a trip, and where she's going she wouldn't need the handbag.
Yes, but only her husband would know that. And that jewelry. Women don't keep their jewelry in a purse getting all twisted and scratched and tangled up.
Well, they hide in their husband's clothes?
They do not. And they don't leave it behind either. Why, a woman going anywhere but the hospital would always take makeup, perfume, and jewelry.
Put that on there. That's inside stuff, huh?
It's basic equipment. And you don't leave it behind in your husband's drawer in your favorite handbag.
Well, I'm with you, sweetie. I'm with you. Tom Doyle has a pat answer.
That Mrs. Thorwood left at 6 a.m. yesterday with her husband.
According to those words.
I wonder if it's ethical to watch a man with binoculars and a long focus lens. Do you suppose it's ethical even if you prove that he didn't commit a crime?
I'm not much on rear window ethics. Dead! It's been strangled, the neck is broken. Which one of you did it? Which one of you killed my son? Oh. You're the worst names. Neighbors like each other, speak to each other, care if anybody lives or dies, but none of you do.
Hello, welcome to Literary License Podcast, and today we'll be discussing Alfred Hitchcock's Jewel in His Crown, Rear Window from 1954. And before we get started, let's find out who's with us. First with us today, we have Jonathan Jantz, the author of The Siren and the Spectre, The Sorrows, The Darkest Lullaby, and numerous other books. Hello, Jonathan, how are you?
I'm amazing. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing peachy. And we also have with us Dave Campfield. He's the director of the Caesar and Otto series of films, and also Under Surveillance. Hello, Dave. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and I'm really happy to be talking about one of my favorite all-time films, easily my top 10.
So before we get started, let's find out what each of us have been up to. So, Dave, what have you been up to?
I've been working on getting a new film off the ground that I've been working on for 10 years. And my inspiration has been much more Hitchcock than it's been modern-day slasher film. And the first film that I ever made that you brought up, Under Surveillance, now available as Say You Love the Devil on Amazon and a lot of other streaming services. I had seen a lot of films on this budget. They were inspired by slasher films and, you know, like second-tier Friday the 13th movies. I was thinking, how do we tell a modern-day Hitchcockian story on no budget? And that film was about a kid who moves back home with his father after 10 years, and the house has been renovated to support three illegal apartments. And the story is about Justin putting the tenants under surveillance to find out who was behind the murder. And that was very much inspired by Rear Window, with hopefully not being derivative of it. But this new film, Wake and the Reaper, it's been occupying a lot of my days and time trying to get this off the ground. It's a script that you've now read. And I'm trying to, and also there's my friend's show, Strange World, which I did some crew work on, had a little cameo in, and that's going to be coming on the Travel Channel starting August 11th.
Ooh, excellent. And what about yourself, Jonathan? What have you been up to?
Well, Dave's stuff sounds pretty exciting. So this is going to be mundane by comparison. But I have, so fairly soon, I think here in about the next 4 months, I'll have Children of the Dark Queen coming out. I'm just doing a little more editing to that one. Actually, probably about 5 or 6 months it'll come out. But anyway, at the beginning of 2020. And then I, this summer, I've been working on kind of a top secret project. This fall, I'm going to be working on editing a book called Marla, which is the creepiest book I've ever done. It's kind of like if you imagine Stephen King's Carrie, if Carrie were evil. It's a little bit like that. It's a murder mystery. And I also have one coming out in 2020 called The Raven, which is a post-apocalyptic book. I call it Mad Max with monsters. So I mean, that's just a handful of things happening. There's another one coming out 2020 with a well-known publisher that I can't name because it hasn't been announced. It's called The Dismembered. It's historical horror. So I like kind of looking at the – we talked about this before the show, but horror is such a diverse genre. And there are all these different categories and different corners, and I like really exploring that and examining each little shadowy corner. So that's what I've been up to this summer. It's been good. It's been productive.
And myself, I'm still working. I've been commissioned to write a computer game script, which I'm in the middle of doing, which is going fine. It's good. It is what it is. And then I'm editing a couple scripts that have been sent to me by my agent. And then watching some interesting television. I've actually been watching the new series on Netflix called, well, the Spanish is La Casa Papel or Bunny Heist, the third season out of that, which is very good. And I've also been watching a new, well, it's actually not a new series, but a new series for me. It's on, well, in this country, it's on Amazon Prime called Animal Kingdom, which is based on an Australian film of 2010 that won a lot of awards at that time. And with Ellen Barkin, very good. It's fantastic. So besides that, yeah, 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, turned my life into a Dolly Parton song. So yeah, besides that, what's going on? So I guess this brings us to Rear Window. Now, Rear Window is a 1954 American Technicolor mystery thriller film that was directed by Alfred Hitchcock and is written by John Michael Hayes, who bases on Cornell Woolworth's 1942 short story, It Had to Be Murder. It was originally released by Paramount Pictures. The film would star James Stewart, Grace Kelly, Wendell Corey, Thelma Ritter, and Raymond Burr. Outside, this is probably the first time I actually knew that Raymond Burr could actually walk, because I always knew him as Ironside, walking, you know, whirling around in a wheelchair. So, yeah, I found out that Raymond Burr could walk. So that was quite good. It was screened at the 1954 Venice Film Festival. It is considered one of Alfred Hitchcock's greatest films. It is in the 100 Years of 100 Movies list, and it's number 48 on that list. And it's also been added to the United States National Film Registry of the Library of Congress as culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant. So, Jonathan, do you have anything about the making of Rear Window that you'd like to share?
I think at that time, it was the largest indoor set ever created for a film. Some of the reading I've done about it, they talk about taking a soundstage and having to excavate down just absurd number of feet in order to accommodate the entire set. And I think, you know, part of that is because of, you know, the plot, and it necessitated that. But I think, you know, Hitchcock had a little of, I know he came before Kubrick, but there's this Kubrickian desire for control. Hitchcock knew what he wanted. And I think that set allowed him, that unique set. And by that time, he had enough, you know, pull and power in the world of filmmaking to get that kind of budget. But I think that allowed him to control basically every aspect of that set. You know, the set really is like another character. It's so central to the plot. And I love, you know, when you look at somebody like Hitchcock, because he was so meticulous, so exacting, yes, there's still little accidents, little glorious miracles that happen that aren't planned, but so much, you know, if you go on the basis that he intended this or that he had some forethought placed into this aspect of the set, I think it becomes triply fascinating. You begin to see so much more in the movie when you realize that all this was under his control. So why was this apartment positioned in this way in relation to another apartment? Why was the lighting like this in this scene? Because he controlled it all. So for me, when I think about Rear Window, the making of it, I think that all that effort in the production, I think is fascinating.
What about yourself, Dave? Do you have anything about the making of Rear Window?
To my understanding, what happened was the way they created that set was Jimmy Stewart's apartment was on the main floor of the set. They dug into the basement in order to create the bottom apartments. So it was a complete reconstruction of the studio that they had in order to accommodate this vision, to centralize it. And in looking at it, some movies, you feel like you're looking at a movie set, and there are times where it feels very convincingly like you're looking out into the world, and you're looking into a real environment. And it's amazing that this story is so effective within the limitations. And Hitchcock tended to like to give himself limitations in telling a story. You never leave that apartment. You never leave Jimmy Stewart's point of view, really. You never venture out. When he gets a phone call, the camera doesn't follow you. It doesn't wind up inside the location of the person he's talking to. The film is very subjective, and for the better. It makes it a very satisfying experience. There's not a lot of music. It's in a lot of ways a minimalist kind of movie. In a lot of ways, it's like a play. But with these limitations, it's more successful than, you know, when he tried to do Lifeboat was another example of telling a story under extreme limitations. Rope was another example of telling a story under extreme limitations. This was the best example of telling that I've ever seen of telling a story within a single room of an apartment. It's amazing the drama, the character work, and how effective it all is. It's a true testament to all their talent. I was going to say that the screenwriter of this story, and he talks about almost not having gotten the job. It's adapted from this 1942 short story. And they essentially reinvented it, because you look at the short story, which I was reading earlier, and it's very first. It's all the thoughts of the character, and he doesn't have the relationship with the Grace Kelly character. He doesn't have a girlfriend. Very few of the residents live in that location. It's thoroughly reinvented from the short story. It had to be murder, mm-hmm. But I feel like this is everybody at the top of their game. Mm-hmm. And I was going to say that the writer had written a screenplay with Jimmy Stewart 2-3 years earlier before he collaborated with Hitchcock. And I hadn't heard of it. So it goes to show you that this was the zenith of all of these people who were involved, other projects that they worked on together I hadn't even heard of, but yet Rear Window stands the test of time. And that we're still talking about it today, and justifiably so.
One other point that's quite interesting is that if you're in New York City and you go to 125 Christopher Street, you can actually see the real courtyard that this was based on.
Really? Huh.
It still stands today, and people are still living in it. So I'm not quite sure you will see James Stewart or Grace Kelly there, because they're long dead. So
they weren't ever there to begin with. You know, in the first paragraph of the short story, the lead character refers to his neighbors as the rear window dwellers around me. So that must be where the title came from.
So what we're going to do, I'll give you a brief synopsis. The synopsis for Rear Window is pretty simple outlay. Basically, a photojournalist in one of the hottest days of summer in New York City finds himself in a cast in order to pass the time. He would watch the neighbors when he thinks one of the neighbors may have committed a murder. So what we're going to do is cut to a commercial break and the trailer for Rear Window, and we'll be back with you after a word from our sponsor.
Amazon. Oops, wrong Amazon. Although we both contain an array of diversity, the rainforest with all of its animals and us with all of our products, come check us over today and find all the products you need quickly and efficiently. and buy it with one click. And now you can even use us to donate to your favorite charities using Amazon Smile. Amazon Smile is worth your while. Come check us out today.
We are one planet. We share one extraordinary home. We are millions of wonders, but we are all one world. If we only get one chance to save our planet, to protect it for the next generation, then we have to take it. This is our chance. This is our fight. For our planet, for our home, for all of us. Join WWF today.
This is the scene of the crime. A crime of passion, filmed in a way you have never seen before. And as no one else would dare attempt, but the screen's master of suspense, the producer-director who shocked the world with Psycho. This is the apartment of a man named Jeffries, a news photographer whose beat used to be the world. Right now, his world has shrunk down to the size of this window. He's been watching the people across the way. Nobody seems to pull their blinds during a hot spell like this. He knows a lot about them by now. Too much, perhaps. For instance, down there on the second floor, the woman pacing about. He calls her Miss Lonely Hearts. So lonely that even death seems like a friend. These are the newlyweds on a honeymoon no one will ever forget. He calls her Miss Hearing Aid, an artist of a very odd and strange art. The songwriter who plays the same melody over and over again. A genius or insane? This is the traveling salesman and his invalid wife. Out of their arguments and nagging comes a weird kind of love. Miss Torso, the body beautiful. That is, viewed from a safe distance.
Those are just a few of my neighbors. First, I watched them just to kill time, but then I couldn't take my eyes off them, just as you won't be able to.
And you won't be able to take your eyes off the glowing beauty of Grace Kelly, who shares the heart and curiosity of James Stewart in this story of a romance shadowed by the terror of a horrifying secret.
Okay, Bradley, tell the class about your holidays.
Yeah, it was really good. My dad built us a new kitchen. It's got wooden bench tops and some stupid soft closing drawers. There was a dishwasher that was a real and even a breakfast bar. Mum thought Dad was a massive.
Get a kitchen installed without teaching your kids new words. Visit ikea.com.au. We can plan, deliver, and install the whole thing for you.
Hello?
What's your favorite scary movie?
I have a bunch of favorite movies. I watch them all on Shudder.com for only $4.99 a month.
That's a scary low price.
But if I had to pick a favorite, it'd probably be Scream.
Oh.
Yeah, it's the only streaming service that lets me watch hundreds of horror movies on demand.
I'll be right back.
Hello? Hello? Hello, are you gonna subscribe? Hello?
Go to Shudder.com to subscribe, if you dare.
Hello, welcome back to the Literary Larson Podcast, and today we're discussing Rear Window, the 1954 Alfred Hitchcock classic. So, Jonathan, what are your thoughts on Rear Window?
One thing that that Dave said a little while ago that I really liked, he's talking about how the limitations that Hitchcock put upon himself in this film, And another director, another modern director who does that, I think that he probably, I mean, almost every modern director worth his or her salt, you know, has seen Hitchcock and probably been influenced in some way. But David Fincher is another guy who does the same thing. You know, it's not always what does he do, it's what does he not do. And with Hitchcock, one, just piggybacking on Dave's thought, one thing he did there in Rear Window, and I think, I agree, I think it's, I don't think it's ever been done better. And the term that Hitchcock used was subjective treatment. But it's putting you in the position, you know, to a degree, it's what all storytellers attempt to do. They attempt to put you in the position of the protagonist. But the way that Hitchcock does this uniquely in Rear Window, one thing I love and one thing that makes it such a rewarding and I think frightening experience sometimes, not just like is physically harrowing, but emotionally harrowing, is that he plays, he sets these rules for himself and then he plays fair. He adheres to them very devotedly. So, for instance, when we fully experience the story through Jimmy Stewart's point of view, basically. We almost never leave it. Hitchcock is so devoted to this point of view, the subjective treatment, that we don't even get. So all these shots are looking out of Stewart's rear windows of his apartment. We don't even get, for example, we have extreme long shot throughout the opening of the movie. We don't get long shot or medium shot or close up of these neighbors until Stewart does. And Hitchcock contrives these ways, and they're very believable in the world of the movie. He gives us, so Hitchcock will pick up these binoculars to go from extreme long shot to long shot. So when Stewart puts the binoculars to his eyes, that's the first time we see Raymond Burr or Miss Torso or whomever a little more clearly. And then we don't get medium shots. We don't get these closer shots. For example, of I think it's of Thorwald. He has this knife that he's kind of cleaning and then wrapping up. We don't get that until Hitchcock, until Stewart employs this powerful lens to his camera. All right. So we don't see things until Stewart sees them. So as the mystery unfolds for him, it's unfolding for us and vice versa. We are Jimmy Stewart, including all his warts, all his emotional problems and idiosyncrasies. It's really a miracle of subjective treatment, of identification with the main character.
What about yourself, Dave? What are your initial thoughts?
Well, just to piggyback on what Craig was saying, that a lot of these techniques are invisible to the viewer, mm-hmm. and you don't realize it's happening, but yet it's very effective and part of the reason why we react to it so much. The technique is almost invisible to the audience. And another technique that Hitchcock is masterful at is giving you more information than the character has. So while the character is sleeping, the camera could veer out the window, give you a detail, something that puts the Stewart character in danger. And that you're one step ahead of him. And the suspense becomes all the greater because there's danger that he's not aware of, that the audience is. And Hitchcock was very masterful in terms of how he did it. Rear Window is my favorite Hitchcock film. And Vertigo gets all the love these days. Vertigo is not as satisfying as a film as Rear Window. I think Rear Window is a complete movie. If you were to watch one Hitchcock film, and so many are great, this would be the one for me. Because it's just a wonderful piece of filmmaking with characters that are so engaging and vivid and fully realized. And from style to writing to just overall impact, I loved it when I first saw it as a kid on television, and I love it to this day. So I think that this, along with Psycho, Strangers on a Train, these are the ones that really impacted me the most. But this is the most satisfying of the films that he's done. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the lines of dialogue in the film are wonderful. And it's not good enough to just have a line that's great. You have to have the execution of the line said just the right way. And I think, you know, when LaCorey's character is looking out the window at Miss Torso, and Jimmy Stewart says, "How's your wife?" There's a lot of great deliveries, including the line, you know, like when Stewart is trying to convince this detective/friend that there might be a murder afoot. And you know, he had a saw on him. It was, Jim, do you want a saw? Yeah. How many people did he cut up with it? There's such, that's not even getting into the Thelma Ritter character yet, but there's just such terrific characterization. And it's a film I watch every year because I love it that much. And I want to see it on the big screen because I know they have revivals of it at times as well. And I'm looking forward to that day I got to see it on the big screen. Like I got to see Casablanca recently on the big screen.
I mean, Rear Window is quite an interesting thing because it's almost like Alfred Hitchcock, if you look at Herzler films coming up to this point, it feels like all of a sudden he's got all the ingredients to come up with the perfect Alfred Hitchcock film. He's got snippets of the comic characters that you would find like in Shadow of a Doubt. You have, or the sheriff in Psycho, and you got that in the Thelma Ritter character. You also got, the everyman. And of course, you got the everyman who finds himself in the middle of a murder or a suspense situation, which is James Stewart character is. But it's also quite interesting that you also got Grace Kelly. Now you got someone that he's actually, he's experimented with like having a beautiful woman, and they're more than just beautiful. They're actually brains. And he brings that out even more in Rear Window. And then of course you have his camera shots and all the Alfred Hitchcock, what makes an Alfred Hitchcock film in Rear Window. But I have to sit there and say that this is where he kind of pulls everything together. He's like, he's almost like made mental notes on everything that he's done to get to this point to make a near perfect. Well, I think it's a perfect film myself. It's not even near perfect. It's been copied so many times, with films like Brian De Palma's Body Double or, Philip Nance's Sliver, to lesser.
Or Dave Canfield's So You Love the Devil.
But even like with Disturbia, 2007, Steven Spielberg produced film, but then when you actually look at, this is what the genius of Hitchcock is, because they did do a remake of this film. They made a television film after Christopher Reeves got in this horrible accident and he was wheelchair bound. So I guess they figured this will be the perfect vehicle for him to do.
And I did see it was a television movie.
But at the same time, it had a great, the cast wasn't bad. It had Robert Forster in it, and it had Daryl Hannah, and Christopher Reeves. But at the same time, the thing is, they used the same exact script. They didn't change the script. They used the same exact script, but it didn't have the magic of Hitchcock. The thing is like, it didn't have the fluid, the fluidity of a Hitchcock film, which it just shows that how much of a master Hitchcock really is. Because, even if you look at, they did the same thing with Psycho. Didn't they do a scene by scene?
Gus Van Sant's shot for shot remake. And it's amazing how much alike and unlike something can be.
Yeah. So that just shows you what a master he is. And especially like when you think of the simple fact that Alfred Hitchcock did not like making movies. He hated the filming of the movies. It's absolutely documented. There's plenty of documentation where he tells you that he hates making the movie. He loves all the before, all the pre-productions. And the thing is, he never once spent a time sitting behind a camera ever. This is a man who sits 3 or 4 feet to the side and then goes, you're a quarter off on that shot. This is the way he looked at things. And then you got Alma, his wife, who is very instrumental in all of Hitchcock films. And she can't watch films normally. When she watches a film, she sees it frame by frame. That's how she watches a film when she's watching it live. And that's why, things like Psycho about bringing clips together and scenes together and shots together, she catches that for him. And of course, without her, you probably wouldn't have the fantastic screenplays, because to be honest, both of them wrote the screenplay. The writer would write it on the screenplay, and then they would come in and tighten it up and do stuff with it and ask for it. So, and it seems like, so I guess what I was stating is that here we got Rear Window, and it is the pinnacle of his career. He does do excellent films after this, of course, as he said with Psycho, and I like Frenzy. I'm a fan of Frenzy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I'm up there.
But this seems like this is one that he's able, this is almost like, this is where he pulls everything together. You know, even got bits of Vertigo in here, you know, with the red shot, you know, and that's quite cleverly done because I have the film on Blu-ray and I have quite a large television. I was watching it. And when you do get that shot, and I did see this in the 1984, 85, they remastered this film and brought it out to the cinema and it did do the multiplexes. And I was in uni at the time and I did go see it. And I had that same effect that when he does the flash, when Raymond Burr answers his apartment, you do get that, you know, when that flash in your eyes where you kind of get that headache that goes to the back of your eyes. And you do experience that, which is quite bizarre.
I wanted to point out, this is my thought watching it last time. What a brilliant bit of writing that you have someone approaching you and you have no means to defend yourself. What can you do? Flashbulb. It's such a clever bit of writing. You know, you put characters in a circumstance that they have to get out of. What's the solution? He's a photographer. He has access to the flashbulbs. He's in a dark room. Blind the guy. You know, and if it was a modern day movie, I don't think they would take that approach. It's clever writing. I feel like when you look at movies like Rope was like the trial run for Rear Window. Doing what he wasn't as successful in Rope as it was in this. Telling a story, because Rope's all in one apartment and so one continuous shot. But it's almost like Rope was an experiment. And he's like, all right, some of it worked, some of it didn't work. He used all the best techniques from that, you know, when he made this. Also with Jimmy Stewart. Here's a question. What color is Jimmy Stewart's hair in this movie? Every time there's a different camera angle, I'm like, is it gray? Is it black? What's going on here?
Oh, he's that distinguished salt and pepper man look, isn't it? I guess it's silver. I mean, it's always kind of that silver pepper, and it just, I mean, what does it go? Was it black when he's sitting in the window, or is it only when he goes into shadow does it turn black?
That's one of the great mysteries of the movie for me. And actually, we haven't even touched on Grace Kelly yet.
Well, she is stunning. I mean,
absolutely.
She's just ultimate stunning beauty, isn't she?
Yeah.
So she has a strange accent.
Or is it an affectation? Like, just the way she's, where is she from? Is she American born?
She's American born. She's from Boston. So she does have kind of this Boston accent that kind of goes.
Or a masked Boston accent. It's like she's hiding it and it winds up sounding a little.
Well, it's kind of, when I was watching it with my flatmate pointed out that she sounds like Katharine Hepburn. You know, that Katharine Hepburn had that same kind of accent, which is kind of like you have this, you know, accent, but then you need this continental American accent. So this is what you get sort of thing.
Right. It's almost like people are trying to train you how to talk. Yeah. And as a result, you sound like you're from nowhere. You sound very effective. But how do you think of them, Craig and Keith, as a couple? Do you buy them as a couple? Do you think, well, he's a little older than she is. Do you think they, when I look at them, I think they got a really unique chemistry. Like they're not the same kind of person. They have different mindsets, but they really seem to work as a couple. They have a great chemistry.
Yeah. First of all, Jimmy Stewart, along with Cary Grant, those are my two favorite actors of all time. And like you, Rear Window is my favorite Hitchcock. I just think it's extraordinary. I think it's perfect. I agree with Keith in that regard. I think Grace Kelly, for me, is the hero of the movie. Lisa Carol Fremont is one of the most amazing characters I've ever seen. She is more than three or four dimensional. She's like seven dimensional. And I feel like the movie largely is about her saving Jimmy Stewart from himself. Not only saving the relationship, but saving him from becoming the worst version of himself. Mm-hmm. And I really look at her as being the hero. And you look at her throughout the film, she's the active one. And Hitchcock, in the screenplay, I love that you guys have talked about the screenplay. The screenplay is brilliant. Not only in its text, but in its subtext. There's subtext throughout. Like, almost every line has more than one meaning. But just some of the more topical lines. I love when Grace Kelly, you know, she and Thelma Ritter, they're the ones, first of all, Lisa, I think her first connection to Thorwald is when she puts the, Well, she goes over first and she sees the address. Okay, so she's the one to get the address. And she said, okay, Jeff, what's my next assignment? And then that's the end for that moment. Later on, she's the one to slip the note under the door to Thorwald. Okay, so again, she's the one coming closer and closer to Thorwald while Jimmy Stewart sits in his apartment, right? Completely out of harm's way, or at least seemingly so. And then, of course, Lisa, there's one point where she says to Jeff, she and Thelma Ritter getting ready to go over there to the courtyard, I think at that point, to dig up the flower bed. And she says, oh, Jeff, if you're too squeamish, just don't look, right? And I love that because, you know, the stereotype, I think there's so much that Hitchcock is saying and the screenwriter's saying, whether they mean to or not, so much is being brought out about like gender politics and gender roles in the film. You know, because I remember when I was a kid, right? And, you know, let's say somebody cries, you strike out during a baseball game, stop being a little girl, right? Is what people, my peers would say to me if I cried after a strikeout. And those really ridiculous sayings that you sometimes, they're turned on their head. And of course, this is, you know, back in 1954. So back when those sorts of sayings would be even more prevalent, right? And so Lisa's the one telling Jeff not to be squeamish. Lisa's the one telling Jeff, you know, to kind of get tougher. And she's the one doing all these things. And what I love also, you know, Jeff is the dynamic character, I think, of the two. Lisa, you could say that she changes over the course of the movie. But what I love is you find out at the very end, she's reading this book that says, you know, after, you know, and during the denouement is Hitchcock's going, which we can talk about if you guys want to at some point, because it's this wonderful, you know, encapsulation of where the characters now are at the end. But we see Lisa and Jeff in those final frames. Lisa is reading a book that says, like, up in the high Himalayas or something like that, right? This adventure book that Jeff would approve of, because he's always talking throughout the movie, you know, how would that dress look in, say, Pakistan, right? Or if you're up in an airplane, how would you survive? So Lisa seems to be reading this adventurous book that Jeff would approve of, but she sees he's asleep. She puts it down, and with this impish kind of smile, she picks up this Harper's Bazaar fashion magazine. And to me, in a way, that's Hitchcock and the screenwriter saying, you know what? There was nothing really wrong with her all along. You know, she was pretty amazing to begin with. You know, if her greatest sin is liking nice dresses, oh my goodness, gasp. You know, what a horrible thing that is, that she likes nice dresses, right? So she, in a way, she grows, but she's also the same wonderful person she was all along. So to me, Grace Kelly she's maybe the most enjoyable part of Rear Window. I think she's extraordinary.
I have to hear some like really interesting things, because before Grace Kelly appears, you do get Thelma Ritter and James Stewart talking about Lisa. And basically she's high society, she's rich, she's a fashion model. And so right then and there, you have this picture of who she's going to be. And of course, when you first see her in, she walks in immaculately dressed. I mean, this woman can wear a dress, like no one can wear one. And then, this is what I quite like about Alfred Hitchcock, when he did work with James Stewart, because James Stewart, you got to remember, he was the everyman. He was he's always played like nice guys, but Alfred Hitchcock always shows James Stewart playing quite, and he doesn't have a nasty side in every single film of Alfred Hitchcock's. And this nasty side comes out of James Stewart, as you were discussing about, oh, you can't do this and you can't do that. And then you have this impression that she leaves, you're like, oh my God, this is going to be a woman that's going to be like, well, at least I got a man, you know, one of those. But she isn't, you know what I mean? Then she comes back and she's like, you know, she's almost like comes back and thinks, fuck you, I'm going to show you. It's like, I can be anything I want to be, but yet still be true to myself, as you were saying. And she proves it, as you said, time and time again. Which now we have a woman that starts off as being like this two-dimensional, but as the film comes on, oh my God, we have this woman that's fleshed out, everyday woman, you know, basically 10 to 15 years ahead of women's liberation. You know, she's got a career, she makes her own money, she has her own house, she's, you know, and everything like this. And she can do whatever she wants to. And she's going to prove it time and time again that don't put me in a box, because this is not me. Yes. And I sit there and say, it's probably one of the, as you were saying, probably one of the best drawn female characters of this time, or pretty much any time, without actually throwing it in your face or poking in the eyes with it.
of Hitchcock's films, certainly. And interestingly, she's nowhere to be found in It Had to Be Murder, the short story. It's a total invention for the movie. He had no relationship. Backtracking a little bit, you were mentioning Disturbia as an outgrowth of this movie, and obviously inspired it. But when you look at the movies that inspired, notably Disturbia, like most Hollywood films of yesteryear and today, it stretches credulity by everything. It's like, this guy has underground lairs, whereas Hitchcock was able to keep everything real and grounded. And that's another beautiful thing about this movie. Is there anything in here that you just roll your eyes and go, oh, that's Hollywood? No, not at all.
I mean, what's also fantastic, which, started doing these podcast stuff like this, you start viewing things slightly different than when I'm just normally watching it. And you start noticing little gems in there. The alley, every time they show the apartment building and you see the alley, there's either kids playing, people walking, cars driving by, people coming in and out of the bar that you can, in this like little bit of an alley. And there, this is almost like, It's a Wonderful Life. When they made It's a Wonderful Life, they put all the animals and everything to live on the set 6 weeks before they started filming that film. So that way everything looked lived in. And this film almost feels like everything is lived in. And that's another thing, as you were saying about the set. And you do feel like they're on vacation. And basically, these are just the extras living their life and, outside the window. And I had to sit there and say, you have to take your hats off to actually have that, because they don't feel like they're acting. You don't like, oh, here's a bunch of kids playing hopscotch and they're acting kids, or here's, Miss Lonely Heart. She's living her life, cooking her dinners and stuff like this. You don't feel like this is an actress. You feel like she actually lives there. And which is quite amazing when you look at 1930s to 1970s, in between that time period, as far as films, there wasn't a lot of natural acting. There was like acting.
Right.
And here we have a lot of natural acting going on at the same time that we have acting going on, which is quite an interesting news.
Jimmy Stewart was always, he was truly the first naturalistic actor as far as I'm concerned, as far as I saw. Before Brando was Brando, Jimmy Stewart was still absolutely natural. Mm-hmm. The neighbors in the short story are different than the neighbors you have in the movie. Mm-hmm. Miss Torso is invented, and a lot of them, and even the newlywed in the short story were described as teenagers just married who left their apartment with always forgetting to turn their lights out. It's funny, the details of what was happening were different of all of the neighbors. And I think the screenwriter Hitchcock came along and they decided who was going to be in the apartments. And they even had like one of the neighbors in place of Miss Lonely Heart was like a young widowed mother in the treatment. So yet they were able to kind of create the perfect characters to inhabit, the musician and all of them, to inhabit this complex. Such vivid characters that you really rarely get a close up of. Really. And yet you know them, you get a sense of them with just through Stewart's point of view. Seeing them from afar.
Yeah.
What an amazing task that is, and what an amazing job they did telling their stories from 100 feet away, or however many feet away that he viewed them from.
Absolutely.
I guess maybe this also has to do with Alfred Hitchcock's background in making silent films as well. Basically, he's so used to silent. I mean, it's kind of weird that Alfred Hitchcock is probably considered one of the greatest American actors, even though he's English. And he comes from an English background, but his background, he learned from filming from American directors and German expressionist directors. That's where he got, that's his background. And how he was able to bring everything together and become part of this American idiom of what film is.
Akira Kurosawa, a famous Japanese filmmaker, said his inspiration was John Ford. So there's always, like, every famous filmmaker takes their influences from other places around the world. You know, Hitchcock's no exception.
Let's face it, we wouldn't have Brian De Palma if it wasn't for Alfred Hitchcock.
And look at some of Spielberg's filmmaking. Spielberg's filmmaking's a lot. I was watching, there was a scene in War of the Worlds where it was subjective point of view of Tom Cruise's character trying to figure out what happened in the aftermath of the power out. It's all subjected through his eyes, looking down at his watch, looking out the window. And it, to me, it felt like that's Hitchcock modern day. So many filmmakers are, especially the best filmmakers, are borrowing from Hitchcock all the time.
Yeah. Keith, one thing, Keith, I wanted to, if you don't mind, you asked earlier, is there any moment that doesn't work, all right, or that seems implausible, anything like that? You know, if you look at this movie, it really, just from a, because I write, you know, scary stories, and a challenge constantly facing either a horror or suspense or thriller writer is making things believable. And creating isolation, either physical isolation or a feeling of isolation. Think about the context of this story. This is a crowded, we're in the middle of this huge city in this crowded courtyard. There are constantly basically people on screen with their windows open because there's no air conditioning. So, you know, Miss Torso, Miss Lonely Hearts, the musician, the bickering couple, the newlyweds, all these, there are people surrounding the main character. So, you know, how on earth do you create a feeling of isolation? How on earth do you create the suspense, you know, when Grace Kelly, and, you know, there's one moment, I find this to be just one of the most brilliant aspects of the film. The moment where Grace Kelly encounters Thorwald in Thorwald's apartment and they begin to struggle, Thorwald turns the lights out and she's screaming, Jeff, Jeff, right? She doesn't scream help. She screams Jeff. And that there's a whole lot to unpack there and examine there. But if you're thinking, really, like if you look at it objectively, what should Jimmy Stewart do in that moment? He and Stella are watching this potential murder unfold, right across the courtyard, this busy courtyard. So how on earth, you know, you think just objectively, what should he do or what should Stella do? The answer, of course, is anything. Say anything, shout. I mean, just a few minutes earlier, you had this moment where the dog was killed. Sorry to give away all the spoilers in the movie. And, you know, the woman screams, the owner of the dog screams, and everybody comes, right? There's a party at the musician's apartment. Everybody comes, seemingly like 50, 60 people. They all come and they're staring in the courtyard. All it was a scream that drew them all. So why doesn't Stuart yell? Why doesn't Stella yell? Why doesn't help come? And the way that this is constructed in the film, you know, Stuart is, if you look at it, he's very stunted emotionally throughout. Like he won't commit. He's a commitment phobe, right? He won't do anything. He's very passive. He just wants to keep things status quo with Lisa. So essentially, he's kind of destroying her emotionally by being emotionally passive and wanting her to remain that way. So in that scene, the only thing that can maintain this isolation of the murder mystery is if Stuart doesn't shout, if he doesn't say anything. So all he does, he like massages the back of his neck. He says, Stella, what do we do? What do we do? And he writhes in this impotent silence in his chair as Lisa is almost murdered before his eyes. And then of course the police come because he's placed the phone call before that. But you know, if you look at that scene, His again, objectively, it seems idiotic that he's not calling for help. But in the context of his character, that passivity that's dooming their relationship, almost dooms her in her life, it's completely believable, right? And it's also that fear of being found out to be the voyeur, why he doesn't yell. But in the context of the movie, it's not implausible. It's completely believable. I find that to be just miraculous, that it somehow works, that he maintains the isolation, not only of the characters, but of that murder mystery, so that bubble can't be pierced by outsiders.
Do you also think that maybe it has to do with the psychological understanding of neighbors in close proximity to each other? Now, you're mentioning before about the dog and that she screams, but she said she screams, you killed him. And that's why, so it wasn't just the scream that brought the neighbors out. And maybe, and my, you know, when I was, my idea would be that the reason why they came is because they thought, oh, we're going to see a murder, a bit like seeing a car crash. Let's all go out and see it sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then you also have to take the idea that, you know, if something happens, you're being attacked in the street, or you are basically you know, mugged or anything like that, the police tell you not to scream out help. You scream out fire because people come running because of fire, because there's something to see.
Right.
And I thought that maybe the reason why she said, you know, Jeff, simple point is like, because if she said help, no one else would take notice. But if she says help, at least she knows there's one person watching. And to actually get that, where she said help, that everyone would probably go on about their lives. And maybe Alfred Hitchcock he does kind of hint at that people go on about their lives, oblivious of what's going on, what their neighbors are up to, stuff like this. I mean, if you see people in real life, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer's neighbors, what do they say? Oh, he's quiet, he kept to himself. You know, John Wayne Gacy, oh, he was quiet, he kept to himself. Meanwhile, he's butchering and murdering people in his yard, and next door neighbors are really close to each other. You know, we did a one about a murder of this girl that was being tortured to death. The neighborhood kids would come and torture this girl, real life story, for 3 months. And if you look at where the crime takes place, the houses are right on top of each other, and no one said anything because everyone's so involved. You know, no one noticed the girl hasn't been outside for 3 months. And I thought that maybe it was like Alfred Hitchcock, you know, because he does, you know, does put a little bit of a social stance in all his films to say what society is like. And I thought the reason why she said Jeff basically is because knowing that if she said help, no one had even taken notice. But even when she's saying Jeff, the neighbors are not, she's screaming Jeff, as loud as she can across the courtyard, and no one comes to the window, mm-hmm. which is quite an interesting thing on how society works in that kind mm-hmm. of way as well.
I agree. So, definitely.
It depends on your society. You know, it's one society, one group of people isn't necessarily indicative of another group of people. Now, when you're dealing with Manhattan, like that famous scene in Ghostbusters, when Rick Moranis' character was eaten outside of a restaurant and they just go right back to their meal after he is, that's one view that's of Manhattan life. But other parts of the world, other places, people run to your defense in a moment's notice.
I think it's more of an understanding of big city life. I mean, I know London's pretty, you know, the bigger the city, the more isolated it seems the inhabitants are, you know, and the smaller you have, like small communities, they tend to be a bit more forthright. But then, I mean, for facing today, I mean, I guess if you're being attacked today, people just film it and put it on YouTube.
Yeah, yep.
Exactly. Yeah. One other thing about that. yeah, for sure. One other thing about that moment too, you talk about the screaming Jeff, and this is this is probably an annoyingly, you know, maybe this is just my own thought. I'm just projecting my own reading here. But, you know, I think that moment where she's fighting with Thorwald in the dark, you know, if you look at that movie, women are light bringers and men are darkness bringers. The first thing Lisa does in the movie is flip on the lights. And she does that multiple times. Thorwald is often seen in darkness, turning out the lights. Jeff has Stella turn out the lights. But that moment where you see two figures fighting in the dark and she's screaming Jeff, I think that is a symbolic, like, retelling of her relationship with Jeff. I think Thorwald is the shadow version of Jeff. Mm-hmm. So she's fighting with Thorwald. That's fighting with Jeff as she's been doing the entire movie. And just as Thorwald is hurting her physically, Jeff has been hurting her emotionally. To me, that's just a retelling of those two figures in the dark.
Let me offer this. You said Thorwald is the shadowy version of Jeff, and they say often in writing that the antagonist is a shadowy version of the lead character. Yeah. Now, is Thorwald, in fact, Jimmy Stewart's character 10 years from now when he's married to Grace Kelly and the relationship got south?
Wow.
When the sex dies. This is what happens when the sex dies in a relationship. yeah, when she's bedbound.
Yep.
I guess I don't know. I don't know if he's ever gonna be proactive enough to want to kill her to a certain degree. Because the reason why I say this is because Jeff's character, I mean, I guess if you take what his career is, he's a photojournalist, or AKA a documentary filmmaker. And what they do, they sit back and know someone's in peril or an animal's being butchered by, you know, being hunted or whatever, you sit back and you don't get involved. You just watch and film. And, you know, like if he, you know, if he's going to, if there's going to be a war taking place and people are being killed around them, he's not going to take sides. He's just going to film it because this is what he does. So maybe, you know, I guess if you're going to unpack Jeff, whether he's going to be that character in 10 years time, probably not. He probably just throw insults at her and then film her, see what her reactions would be. I don't think he'd actually kill, you know, go to the point of murder. He wouldn't want to get involved. He wouldn't want to get involved too heavily in that relationship.
I have a question. What is the relationship between Thelma Ritter's character and Jeff? I mean, she seems to be a personal masseuse, a personal helper.
She's an insurance nurse. He broke his leg, and basically she's the insurance nurse, which at that time you had, when you had insurance and you got injured and you were homebound, your insurance would pay for a nurse to come by, and they would basically give you therapy. So she's like with the, in this case, the physiotherapy included the masseuse, and then made sure that they had a bit like home help, that, you know, make sure that the dinner was out or the lunch was out for them. And that's what her character is. So there's no really personal connection beyond her being this. But I think what we have with Thelma Richards' character in here is that she's down home. She tells it what she's like. She shoots for eight from the hip. So she's not professional to that extent where she's just everything's profession. She's the kind of person that would enter your house and just chin wag about anything with you, which, trust me, I work in a hospital. We have plenty of those. So,
she's such a vivid New Yorker. You know, this character could have easily been humdrum, but they give her such life and she runs with it.
Yeah, I think
that's the beauty of Thelma Ritter. I mean, if you see, I know that we were discussing before we started recording that you don't know where she's from. She's very memorable in All About Eve. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's Betty Davis's housekeeper in All About Eve. She's also done plenty of Alfred Hitchcock episodes, Twilight Zone, Outer Limits. And what's interesting about Thelma Ritter as a whole is she's the third number one actress to be nominated the most times for an Oscar, but never won.
Really? Well, it's good to be nominated, isn't it? She's always she's always in a role of servitude in these movies.
Yeah, but she also won a Tony Award for The New Gal in Town, and it's the first time and last time that two stars won Best Actress tied in the same movie, the same play. So she won a Tony Award for that as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess this is the magic of Alfred Hitchcock as well. I mean, he has these character actors that come in and just lift everything up. Mm-hmm. You know, every single film you do have this character actor that comes in, or some character actor at the side making comment about the murder or something like this. And that's what I love. This, what makes this movie more for me is Thelma Ritter's character. I just look at her and just love her.
Yeah. I mean, she is a truth teller. All right, she brings truth. Jimmy Stewart's character, Jeff, is all about self-deception, self-delusion, right? His argument for not wanting to marry Lisa is that she's too perfect, right? Mm-hmm. And Stella calls him out for how ridiculous a reason that is, right? Mm-hmm. She talks about her and Miles, her husband, and she said, when we got married, we were a pair of maladjusted misfits. We are still a pair of maladjusted misfits, and we've enjoyed every moment of it. And I think, you know, you asked earlier, or you mentioned earlier, Dave, about the marriages and will Jeff and Lisa, and this, it goes back, one of you used the word satisfying. I think, Dave, you said this is the most, this is so satisfying, and maybe I sound like a Pollyanna here, too sunny, but to me, there are three marriages throughout the film in the apartments. There are the newlyweds, which are the idealized version of marriage. There's the couple with a dog, right, who sleep head to foot on the fire escape. So they don't have a perfect life, but they're together and they stick together. And then you've got the negative version with Thorwald and his wife, right, where they're always bickering and fighting. And that's, by the way, how Jimmy Stewart perceives marriage in the beginning of the movie. He's talking to Gunderson, his editor, and he says, can't you just see me with a complaining wife? And you know, he sees marriage as a prison. And I think what we get to at the end is what Hitchcock is saying is that marriage, like Stella said, is not all horrible. It's not all perfect because the newlyweds are fighting at the end, right? But we see that couple that stuck together through thick and thin, that didn't have a perfect life. They have a new puppy at the end, right? And they're still together in the end of the movie. I think that's Jeff and Lisa. So they have become like that fire escape couple. They've become like Miles and Stella. They've become an imperfect, perfect couple. One that, you know, doesn't fit together maybe ideally, but will love each other and have a good marriage.
I think also what's quite interesting is also is the layers of where they place Jimmy Stewart's flat or apartment. Mm-hmm. And he also, if you notice, like the women who are single are on the bottom floor.
Lonely, you know, heart.
You have this sort of thing, and then he's able to look down on them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have, and then of course the next level, you do have, you know, Thorwell, and he's still slightly above them, but he's suddenly looking slightly down on them. And then the one person that you also have the ballet girl, which he, you know, he's slightly above her as well, passing judgment on her, which is his judgment is totally wrong by the end, which is quite interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, actually Lisa's judgment about her was quite interesting as well, about, you know, what is it, juggling a bunch of wolves sort of thing, which is quite interesting. And then you see what she has at the end, but you know, he's always slightly above, but then the one person that's above him is the piano player, which he doesn't have a lot of comments about him at all. So, which is quite interesting. So people who are below him from his side of view that he can actually look into their lives, he comments on them, and he has this idea what these people all are, and he has their eye, you know, their personalities and everything, even though it didn't seem to me that he's ever had a conversation with any of these people, ever.
Well, you know, the truth is, with all of these moving parts, you have to really be strategic with what you express, because it's limited, it's not wall-to-wall dialogue. When you look at It Had to Be Murder, the amount of thoughts that are in his head, you know, the temperature, the flies are buzzing around, there are so many thoughts, you get to know exactly what he's thinking. And film being its own medium, you have to be very strategic with what he's thinking. So it's not to say he doesn't have any thoughts on the piano player. They're just choosing not to express it because it's going to cloud the overall story too much. And they really focused in on what was most important amongst his thought process.
But he doesn't. But he also understands that he doesn't know the names of any of his neighbors. He's given them all names based on personalities he thinks.
First sentence, I didn't know of the story. I didn't know their names. I've never heard their voices. I didn't know them by sight, strictly speaking, for their faces were too small to fill in with identical features from this distance. So, yeah, true to the story that there is no relationship.
Yeah. So he's just up there in his perch judging them. Like God. but then again, that's it. But that's what I also think is quite interesting, that I, you know, because in the short story, he doesn't have a career, does he, in the short story? He's just a man that happens to be home. Where I think, isn't it Hitchcock that gave him the photojournalist career, which gives it a bit of colorization of this personality, which gives you a little bit more.
Yeah. And look at the tools it gives him as a, in the course of the plot, look, staring in with the long lens, zooming in and flashbulbs, it gave him a lot to do within the story. It gave him a lot of tools to use within the story by making him a photojournalist.
Yeah, and it's the most uniquely visual, right? This whole thing is about scopophilia, about voyeurism. He is the ultimate voyeur, not only out the window, but in his profession.
Yeah, quite interesting. I like Thelma Ritter and how she brings out Lisa's character. You know, when she's like talking about like, oh, you know, it probably killed her in the bathroom because it's easier to clean up the mess. And then, but what I love about that sequence is that, you know, you get Lisa going, oh, Stella. And it's like, but she's got like this like wicked grin on her face. Like she's actually enjoying Thelma Ritter, what she's saying, like being all gruesome. But Lisa quite likes the bit of the gruesomeness of it all. And then you see like James Stewart's face, and he's like mortified by this is being even said, which is quite funny because, well, then again, you know, I guess this is kind of a construct that in society that we think that women can't deal with gore and stuff like this, but the thing is women in their daily lives probably deal with more gore than men ever do, whether it's having kids who are throwing up and being sick, or you know, and carrying on from that. So I quite like that. I think that's, I like the dynamics that we have between Lisa and Stella in this as well. Mm-hmm. They're like two women, completely different, but yet they get each other. And that's what I quite like. Yeah. Another thing that I found quite interesting is that at the end we have James Stewart. He falls out of the window and he breaks both legs. Now, I guess we could see that basically with Lisa, after he fell out of the window, now he's at the mercy. I mean, before he only had one broken leg, now he's got two broken legs and he's completely emasculated.
So. Yes, for sure. Yeah,
the movie ends with him with a little smile on his face, though. So it seems. So he, wow. This time he's happy though. Like he's trapped, but he's happy.
The word I would use. He is trapped, but the word I would use there at the end, rather than trapped, is sedentary. You know, now he is. So to me, the Rosetta Stone of the film that unlocks the whole thing. There's a line that Stella says, the line that everybody knows is that we've become a race of peeping Toms, okay? That's one of the most famous lines of the movie. But what she says afterward is what people ought to do is get outside and look in for a change. And of course, Stewart, in his characteristically oblivious way, dismisses it, Reader's Digest, blah, 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 you know, makes fun of what she says. So what that is to me is an invitation to introspection. Because Stewart is like one of the least introspective characters, at least at first. He's looking out, everything is outward, looking outward for happiness, looking out at other people, examining them. He never examines himself, never examines his own attitudes and behaviors. And look at what Thorwald does to Stewart at the end. Stella says people need to get outside and look in for a change. Thorwald literally pushes Jeff outside his window. So he's dangling from the window, looking in. And what does he see when he looks in his own apartment? Thorwald. All right. So he is looking in, and that is a change, right? And then he falls. I think it's a manifestation of that line from Stella. And, you know, what he sees isn't great. He falls down, breaks his leg. So again, if you look at the shots that bookend the movie, at the beginning of the movie, he is looking inward, but he's scowling and sweating and uncomfortable. And his leg, his cast has an epitaph. Here lies the broken bones of L.B. Jeffries, R.I.P. At the end, yes, he has two broken legs, but there's no epitaph, all right? So he's no longer dead. And as he looks inside, he's smiling and content and comfortable. So yes, he's sedentary, but he's happy to be that way. I'm not suggesting that he's no longer a photographer, but he's happy with what he has. He's looked in for a change, and he realizes that he's got this extraordinary woman, right? And he's finally figured it out. At least I think he has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I have to agree with you. I think he's content. It's probably the first time in the whole film that you find him being content. And he's not cantankerous anymore either. He's quite cantankerous throughout most of the movie.
Oh my goodness. Absolutely.
He's the kind of...
You know, a lot of it is that Lisa became a partner rather than a trophy. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big contributor in terms of why he's smiling at the end. They did this together.
Which is why I think she's wearing the jeans at the end, right? She's wearing dresses throughout, and it's that old saying, "Who wears the pants in the family?" I think they share the dominance, they share the control at their partners, as you said.
I do find what's quite interesting is that, you know, we're I guess we're brought up thinking that voyeurism is a bad thing, and that we should keep people living their lives, and we shouldn't be, you know, watching people all the time. Where Rear Window is kind of odd because through Jeff's voyeurism, he catches a murder and he's able to save someone from committing suicide, mm-hmm. which is quite an interesting take on it. Because normally when you have voyeurism, basically it's like you see all the bad points, and, you know, and we do see it, you know, whether, you know, they do, you know, nods to this film. Body Double is about the evil of voyeurism, you know. Sliver, the evil of voyeurism. Even Disturbia, there's the evil of voyeurism, you know, threaded through. Where Rear Window kind of celebrates voyeurism, because the only person that's really in danger is Jeff himself at the end, really. But if you look at simple fact that he comes to a realization, he comes to an understanding of himself. He gets a revelation of what life is. And I don't know if this is from dangling out the window and all of a sudden his life flashing before his eyes, or for the simple fact that by studying everything around him, he actually was able to make sense of his relationship with Lisa. He's able to make sense more of the neighbors of going on around him. He realized that, you know, and like, you know, as you said, when he's being thrown out the window and he's looking in, he also realizes that he's no better than anyone else as well. And you do get the, and I think that's quite interesting about Rear Window as well, that it works on all these kind of certain kind of levels. That
One thing I love about that that you're talking about, I do agree, it's very gradual and believable. It's not like this, you know, this incredible epiphany. There's a scene where Miss Lonely Hearts is being assaulted, right? She goes out, she's very lonely. She brings a man home, a young man who starts to very aggressively try to kiss her. She pulls the blinds, but then we still can see him push her down on the couch. It's this really disturbing scene. But what's fascinating, and this is where the performances, I think, are just so marvelous. If you look at the reaction shots of Jeff and Lisa as Miss Lonely Hearts is being assaulted, and then as she shoves the man out of her apartment and breaks down crying, Lisa looks kind of fascinated, like she can't believe that this man is doing this. Because she doesn't think of people as being that evil. At least that's my take on her reaction. Mm-hmm. Jeff, if you watch him, looks guilty. Like he can't even look up at her at the Lonely Hearts scene anymore. He's looking guilty, which begs the question, why? Why would that particular episode make him feel guilty? Because
maybe he could have helped and he didn't.
I think so. And I think maybe he's awakening to this idea that there's an awful lot of mistreatment of women around him. And maybe he's not been, because if you ask him at the beginning of the movie, are you a good person? Like most people, I think he'd say yes. I think he's starting to realize that, no, he's not over there on the couch assaulting this woman, but does he treat women well? Does he see them as equals, as human beings? And I think over the course of the movie, he starts to realize that his attitudes are not particularly healthy. And I think that's all. And he, like you say, he doesn't help. And he's oblivious so much of the time. There's this moment where Stella, she comments that there's enough pills in that bottle for to put everybody in Hackensack to sleep. So Stella implies that it's suicide. Jimmy Stewart sees Lonely Hearts writing a note. She sets a note aside. And Jeff says, oh, Stella was wrong about Lonely Hearts. No, she's not. Of course Lonely Hearts is committing suicide. And eventually Jeff helps save her. But at that moment, it's as though he doesn't realize what that note is. He's so clueless about the people around him that what does he think she's writing out? Her laundry list, her grocery list? Of course that's a suicide note. She's writing it out. She's got the pills, the cup. And to me, I think, like Keith said, it's this slow dawning realization, this change that's occurring in him, but they're all stages, but he fights it with his own obliviousness. All right, go ahead. Sorry, guys.
No, I kind of agree. I mean, as far as Miss Lonely Hearts, I mean, when it starts out, he talks about her with a bit of disdain. Like, isn't she pathetic? She's looking for love. And there is that, you know, he doesn't actually use those words, but he goes, oh, it's Miss Lonely Hearts. And just from the sarcastic phrasing that he does when he mentions her name, and there is like a past judgment on it. And I kind of, you know, but then he also, from what you were saying about the guilt, I mean, you know, he was looking at the girl. I mean, he judged the ballerina girl when she had all the men there. To him, it's like, oh, she's just using these men because basically, you know, she's young and free and she's that kind of girl. And, you know, but we do find out she's not that kind of girl. And I think this is where, you know, Rear Window is quite interesting because you're painted with what these people are at the very beginning and who they are. You got this woman who's the nosy neighbor, who's not actually a nosy neighbor. All she is being friendly, but you think that she's a nosy neighbor. You got the young ballerina girl who has men coming to her apartment, and you think, oh my gosh, she's a floozy, maybe she's a slut or whatever. She's not. She's married. She's got a guy. You know what I mean? And, you know, and you have Miss Lonely Hearts. It's like, okay, she's looking for love and stuff like this, but, you know, you think that all she wants is a boyfriend, but you actually realize it's a lot deeper than what you think it is. Mm-hmm. You have the couple upstairs who, you know, yeah, they have the dog and stuff like this. And you think, okay, well, there's just this boring ass couple and they got a dog and they're this, but then you realize, no, there's something different. You know, she makes the whole, you know, when the dog's dying, what she says about the neighbors is correct. You know, what did this dog ever do to you? All he wanted to be is loved. All you wanted is love. And what you do, you kill the one thing on that. So this is the worst thing, this thing I ever wanted. And it's one of you killed him. And all the neighbors, they turn around in shame after she says this, and they go back to their lives because, and it's quite interesting. But then, but you do have the change afterwards, that what you think these people are, and this movie sets up, well, who do you think these people are through the eyes of James Stewart and through our own eyes as well. I mean, we're coming up with our own assumptions while we're watching this. It's not just James Stewart giving us these feedbacks and telling us what we should think about these characters. We are, as an audience, coming in, and we're coming in with our own feedback of who we think these people are. And of course, and then by the end of it, they're different than who they are. You know, the guy upstairs who's basically, you know, he's a failed musician. Well, we find out by the end, he's not a failed musician. You know, we find out he's actually more than, by the end of it, he has a girl, you know, Miss Lonely Hearts come up there and he goes, oh, I have this song, it says come out. So you realize, well, actually, he's successful. He's not a failed musician like we were led to believe. And I think that's also what's, you know, the magic of Rear Window is like, we start out thinking things a certain way. And then by the end of it, we've realized that everything that we thought at the beginning, basically our own criticism thrown back in our face.
Yep. Now, Craig was mentioning about Miss Lonely Hearts, why does Jimmy Stewart, why does Jim feel guilty? And I think it's, you went for a very complex answer. And I think the simple answer was that he didn't have any empathy toward these people. He didn't see their pain. Mm-hmm. So when he sees that Miss Lonely Hearts is a human being, he feels bad that he's been looking at her as a source of entertainment. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the simple. I think maybe that's more in line with what Hitchcock was going for. You were able to go deeper, but I think just in a nutshell, it's like I was looking down on all these people and they're just like me. They have their pain and I feel bad for just trivializing their lives.
Right. Yeah.
Now, I think that's also quite interesting is the actual murder itself. I don't know if you know a little bit about Alfred Hitchcock, you know that he loved true life murder. He relished in it. He would collect books on it and read them over and over. And the murder in this is actually based on a real life case of Dr. Crippen. Now, Dr. Crippen lived in an apartment building. He killed his wife, put her head into a hat box and buried her and cut up her body and spread it throughout, but also buried her in the garden. How they caught him basically is that people realized that the garden flowers were higher than normal and they couldn't figure out. No, they were lower than normal, and the wife was missing, and the neighbors in Crippen, which happened in London, all got together, and this is how the police caught him and actually realized. But, you know, but what he did was, but when they actually realized this, is was the simple fact that he ran off with a sailor mate of his, who was this woman he was having an affair with, and he dressed her up as a sailor, and these two went on a cruise together in this Navy ship. And not no one realizing that this was a woman, realizing that, and the captain realized that they were a bit too friendly. And that's how, that was led to that. And then the neighbors all came forward and talked about certain things that they have experienced. So actually Rear Window is actually based on the case of Dr. Crippen murdering his wife, which is quite interesting when you find that out. And you can see the little bits of the case inside the film once you realize that, you know, the cutting up in the bathroom, the head in the cat box, body parts in the garden. So,
was that after the 1942 short story and it was worked into it, or was that part of the 1942 short story?
Alfred Hitchcock liked to mix in real life murder cases in all his movies because he was that. So Dr. Crippen, I believe, happened in 1939.
Okay, so that's in a short story then.
So I think it's just the murder in the short story. They don't really go into too much detail. I think it's I think the detail of the murder of the wife, I think that's what Alfred Hitchcock probably added to the screenplay. You know, same thing like with Friends. Based on real life cases and stuff like that.
Interestingly, Hitchcock definitely had an incredible amount of input in the screenplay. He's not listed as a screenwriter. But like Spielberg, working so closely with the screenwriter, shaping it with him, but not taking the credit for it.
Mm-hmm.
because his Hitchcock's fingerprints are probably all over it. You know, gave a lot of direction.
There's only one film of Hitchcock's that he didn't have any say in the screenplay, and that was his first American movie, Rebecca, because David O. Selznick was a megalomaniac. So,
well, it worked out pretty well in that film. It's his only Best Picture winner.
Well, I think the reason why is because you're never going to find found footage or cut scenes or anything like that on Alfred Hitchcock, because he only shot what he's going to use. And how he and what he did with David O. Selznick, though they still remain close in Rebecca, is that, yeah, he shot the film, but David O. Selznick had a way of going back in and re-editing. So he tried to do that with Rebecca, but they realized there was no more footage. All there was what was that. There's no way to re-edit it.
It goes to show you just how disciplined of a filmmaker Hitchcock was.
Yeah.
You know, like, really knowing what he wanted. He might have been a bit of a bastard, but according to many people. He had the tricks and the games that he would play on people was, I think, by today's standard, sadistic, and probably would. If Hitchcock, if around today, might be a band filmmaker. He might be a Bryan Singer or somebody that gets put in a doghouse because of his treatment of fellow actors, actresses, crew members at times because of his wicked sense of humor and otherwise bad behavior. But yet, he's one of the great filmmakers we've ever had.
Well, it's quite funny because like that thing that he says that actors are all cattle. Apparently, he never actually said that, which is quite, there's a lot of folklore when it comes to Hitchcock. And, since we've done a whole season, I've done quite a bit of research behind him. And it seems like the only person who ever actually complained about Hitchcock was Tippi Hendred.
But the thing is very justifiably. And I go beyond that. I mean, if you listen to the Behind the Bastards podcast on Alfred Hitchcock, which is very well researched by Robert Evans, there was a lot of things that Hitchcock did that would today get you arrested. So pranks that he played that were beyond good taste, borderlining, if not outright sadistic. Like there is a story about a Hitchcock challenging a crew member to stay the night on a set, chained to a piece of equipment, and if that person stayed, they would win an extra week of wages. And they said to keep you company, and one crew member said yes, and to make the experience a little easier, here's a bottle of brandy. Person was up for the challenge, was handed the bottle of brandy, but it wasn't brandy, it was a laxative. So he was chained overnight and shat himself all night long. And
this is based on the guy being an idiot. I mean, come on. I mean, it's like, he's not like he chained him there. He offered it. The guy said, yeah, I'll do it. It's like, it's a bit like my sister. I used to pay her $1 every time she stuck her tongue on the electric fence, and she would do it. And I would never give her $1. It took a
stupid time. You're a bastard too.
I told my sisters to go, we'll play hide and seek. And I would unscrew the doorknobs of the closet. They go hide in the closet. And of course, they can never get out. And I would leave them there for 2 hours. But the thing is, and I would do this time and time again. They still did it. So am I the asshole? Yeah, I'm the asshole when I do it the first time. But if you're doing it the 2 or 3 times, they're the asshole. Because it's like, they're repeating it. They're not learning their lesson.
I'm still going to say that Hitchcock really stepped over the line a few times, even if it's in the interest of comedy. But if it's in the interest of comedy and you physically torture somebody, it's still questionable.
Yeah, but another thing that's kind of odd about Alfred Hitchcock is that everyone always wanted to work with him again. So that's why, I'm not saying that any of these stories are not true. That's not what I'm saying. But sometimes it makes you wonder, because he always worked with the same crew time and time again, and they always signed up for everything he did. And if they weren't doing that, they were doing the TV series. And then all the actors and actresses always wanted to come in and do more and more with him, which I find, then you do hear these stories, is what you're saying. And there's lots of stories out there. But I don't know. It's kind of weird that maybe they loved the sadisticness of him. Maybe that was part of the drive.
Or it could just be because he was the best damn filmmaker there was, and there was a plus side, positive side to his personality. I mean, some people who have great personalities also have a very dark side to them, and there definitely was, as the title of a book connotes, the dark side of Hitchcock.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting. I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, every great artist, there is a dark side. Let's face it.
I mean, Picasso, for crying out loud, there's a long list, and more so in generations past, of questionable behavior of the artists that whose work we love so much.
Yeah, and I think the time period had a lot to do with that too. Like, what was permissive then? What was permitted then, I think, you know, versus now. You know, and you hear all these stories about directors driving actresses and actors just far beyond reason, like Kubrick, what Kubrick did with Shelley Duvall in The Shining. You know, yeah. At the time, there are so many people there that could have intervened and recognized that it wasn't right or fair or healthy. But, you know, people, you know, kind of, there are a lot of apologists that are like, well, you know, he's a genius, it's part of his method, whatever. I don't think the same thing would happen today. You still have demanding directors, like David O. Russell is notoriously demanding. But I think that, you know, in a modern context, I don't think the same things would happen. I think, you know, with Hitchcock, the same thing, you know, maybe it was certain behaviors were more normalized and accepted back then that probably shouldn't have been. And I love Hitchcock as a filmmaker. But, you know, by many accounts, he had some serious behavioral problems at times.
Mm. I think if he was alive today, I'd still hang around with him. I'd find it funny.
Yeah, I mean, there's all
the receiving end.
There's that series of Peter Bogdanovich interviews with Hitchcock that gives you that real indication of what he was like as a person when he wasn't pranking you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just the depth. I mean, like any other artist, his perceptions are a little bit different necessarily than other people's, but it's what makes him unique, kind of looking at life a little differently than most people.
Well, sometimes you kind of wonder if he had mother issues, because if you look at all his films and there is a mother in them, the mother doesn't always come off as the greatest character, do they?
Mm, no.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Whether you look at Marnie or, you know.
Well, Psycho, obviously.
Well, I mean, that's just a mother who really loved her son. Who loved her son. It's more to love. So, is there anything you'd like to add about the overall experience of Rear Window? Anyone? So what we'll do is we'll go to our final thoughts. So, Dave, what are your final thoughts of Rear Window?
As I stated before, my favorite Hitchcock film, and sadly been elapsed by Vertigo, and I think that really should be inverted. It's like, it's kind of interesting that some people consider a unsatisfying ending to be daring and artistically deeper than an ending with closure. And I'm going to go for closure every time out. And Rear Window has that. And I think it comes together as a beautiful puzzle. You've seen all the pieces constructed. The movie's over. All the pieces are together. And you're looking at a beautiful image. Whereas a movie like Vertigo doesn't have that level of satisfaction, even if it, artistically it's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah. I think Vertigo is kind of, for me, it's kind of like when you go to an art show and there's like pails hanging off ropes and people are calling that, well, this is fantastic art. And it speaks about man and his elements and all this other stuff. And I think Vertigo is kind of like that because it has that whole psychoanalysis thing going on in it. And I think that's probably the reason why, it's overshadowed, because people are feeding like, oh my God, it has this psychoanalysis in it. And it's all about loss and fear. And, you know, and they put a lot of this stuff in, which they can do. And I think probably that's the reason why maybe Vertigo is probably overshadowed Rear Window. Because Rear Window is what you see, what you get. And Vertigo, I guess you could feed things into it to make it more artistic. Well, it's artistic.
Yeah, I mean, is it just people are frustrated writers themselves and want to create things? Whereas Rear Window, it's all on the page. You know, it's Vertigo, it sort of wants you to do some of the work. I feel like.
What about yourself, Jonathan? What are your final thoughts of Rear Window?
I forget which it was at the beginning of the conversation. One of you two, you were talking about how this is everything maximized. This is where everybody is at the top of his or her game. And I couldn't agree more. I do think it's one of a handful of perfect movies. This movie, Jaws, there are a few that I consider perfect. And you know, one thing we've alluded to the musician. And this is again something I just love. If you look at that composer, I think that's another. I kind of view. Okay, so Stewart's apartment. If you look at a wheel, his apartment is the hub, and all these other apartments are the spokes. Right, they're connected by spokes. And that composer, I think his story is Stewart's story. I think, and this is just, again, this is something you don't have to notice as you watch the movie. You can enjoy it without thinking about this. But to me, it adds another layer. And, you know, this is one of those things I have to confess, I probably am reading a bit into it, but I do think this works. I've been teaching the movie for 16 years to high schoolers, and I see it 3 times a semester. So you just do the math on that. And I've seen the movie quite a few times, and I've had, you know, so many bright students see things and point them out too. But this composer, I think the song that the composer creates, that is the relationship between Jeff and Lisa. There's a lot to really kind of cement that reading. You know, he, as the song goes the relationship. The moment when the relationship is at its lowest point is when, that's when she walks out and she says goodbye. He says, "Don't you mean goodnight?" She says, "No, I meant what I said. Goodbye, at least until tomorrow night," right? And she walks out. And at that point, the composer walks home. It's like at some point, right around that moment, he walks home, he's drunk. He looks at the sheet music and he slaps it, right? He just shatters the music, slaps it, doesn't play a single note. That's when the relationship's at its worst. When the composer plays just a few little chords of that song, just these halting little beginnings, that's when the relationship starts to come back together again. And in the final scene, the song that's played is the song he's been trying to compose the entire movie. It's the manifestation of all his work. And the song is called, I Believe, Lisa. All right. And you find out also that the composer, he and Lonely Hearts, they come together. And the song is what takes Lonely Hearts away from her pills. All right. So so as the song, it's kind of beautiful because you go back to the beginning of the movie, the composer is, we hear this radio and we see Stewart, the camera floats over to the composer. "Men, are you over 40? Are you feeling listless and run down?" He twists off the radio angrily. Okay. So he is as discontented as is Stewart. They are like doppelgangers for each other emotionally in the state of their lives. At the end, just as the composer saves Lonely Hearts, she kind of saves him too, which I think is really beautiful. And they end up together just as Jeff and Lisa end up together, kind of saving each other. And, you know, this is something that you don't have to notice as you watch, but the story is so complete. Every little arc within every one of those characters in these other apartments, Lonely Hearts, the composer, they all have these little arcs. You've mentioned, Keith, Miss Torso. She has this beautiful character arc over the course of the story where she turns out to be something different than what she is. And I think that it's that nuance, it's that meticulous attention to detail, lavishing attention onto these minor characters that makes it so ultimately rewarding. To me, it's the most rewarding and rewatchable film maybe ever made. And to me, it is the pinnacle of Hitchcock's career.
And I have to agree with both of you. What I love about Rear Window is it is watching Alfred Hitchcock, if you follow his career, when you get to Rear Window, he's mastered every little piece of great characters. No actor, no line is wasted. The musical score is fantastic. It doesn't, you know, it's probably the only Alfred Hitchcock where the musical score actually doesn't overtake anything. It actually lends itself to the score, you know, not like Bernard Herrmann that we normally get, or even Franz Waxman, who wrote, you know, the opening credits for this. His music normally tend to, you know, if you watch All About Eve or anything like that, his scores tend to be a bit syrupy and over. But it seems like Alfred Hitchcock has his finger on everything, the pulse of everything that's going on, and it takes I call him the maestro conductor in this film. He was able to, you know, he's like the most fantastic conductor who takes all these bits of pieces and blends it all together and makes everything work to 100% of a degree. And I'd say it is one of my favorites. This follows up with I love North by Northwest because I quite like some of the humor. And I think Cary Grant's mom, and that's fantastic. But this film is fantastic for me. And anytime I see Thelma Ritter in anything, I am there. She just cracks me in the days. So this brings us to the end of Rear Window, the 1954 Alfred Hitchcock classic. So before we say goodbye, Jonathan, where can people find you?
Probably the best way is to subscribe to my newsletter. But I am on, and you can find that at my website, jonathanjans.com. I am on Twitter and Facebook and Goodreads and Instagram, Jonathan Jans at most places. Love to connect with readers, love to connect with all of you. So if you'd like to look me up, send me a request or follow or whatever, and I'll love to hang out with you all.
And what about yourself, Dave? Where can people find you?
My official website is fourthhorizoncinema.com, and you can just find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DaveCampfield, all one word, or just type in Dave Campfield into Facebook, and there.
And that brings us to the end. So basically, voyeurism, which is one of my favorite pastimes. So whenever I'm bored, I like to watch my neighbors and judge. And if you'd like to do that, make sure you join us next week when we do Dark Shadows, episodes 1 through 25, with special guest star Catherine Lee Scott, who played Maggie Evans. We'll be doing an interview with us. And we'll also be here with Vicky Ray and Tom Diamond. Now, you can also find us at www.llpodcast.com, and you can also subscribe to our newsletter, which comes out monthly, and you can find out all the information and view websites of our guests, and if they are writing books or you can find their films, you can also have a link on there so you can have easy access to buy their stuff by Amazon.com. Remember, if you're going to watch Dark Shadows with us, make sure you do subscribe to Amazon Prime, which you can find that in your local place. And all the episodes of Dark Shadows, all 2,158 episodes of that, are available on there. So you can also find us on our social platforms, which is Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, Reddit, and various others. So for me, this is good night, and good night from Jonathan. Say good night, Jonathan.
Love you all.
And good night from Dave.
Good night, guys.
And we'll see you next week with Dark Shadows, episodes 1 through 25, with our special guest star, Catherine Lee Scott.
Did you get my note? Well, did you get it, Thorwald?
Who are you?
I'll give you a chance to find out. Meet me in the bar at the Albert Hotel. Do it right away.
Why should I?
Little business meeting. To settle the estate of your late wife.
I don't know what you mean.
Come on, quit stalling, Thorwald, or I'll hang up and call the police.
I have only $100 or so.
That's a start. I'm at the Albert now. I'll be looking for you.
He's watching. He's watching me. Double-breasted suits. You're pleading. You say,
wanted the Tommy a little bit of innocent fun. I love my neighbors like a father. And the judge says, well, congratulations. You've just given birth to 3 years.